This is the Afternoon Magazine. Good afternoon. I'm Celeste Quinn. Thanks for tuning in today. Did you know young men today account for less than 43% of those enrolled in college? There are 2.5 million more female undergrads than male undergrads. Is this a problem? Journalist Peg Tyre says it is. She also says there are other problems involving boys and male adolescents and school. Here's some other data she cites. Boys are 5 times more likely than girls to get expelled from preschool. While girls continue to catch up to boys in math and science, boys continue to lag in reading and are falling behind in writing. In this portion of the program, we're going to talk with Peg Tyre about her report card on boys and school and what parents and educators can do to help all children achieve their best. Peg Tyre is the author of The Trouble with Boys, a surprising report card on our sons, their problems at school, and what parents and educators must do. Listeners, I invite you to join our discussion this afternoon with your questions and comments. You can join us with a telephone call. The number in the Champaign-Urbana area is 333-9455. That's 333-WILL. We also have a toll-free number. That number is 800-222-9455, 800-222-WILL. Peg Tyre is an award-winning journalist. She was until recently a senior writer at Newsweek, specializing in social trends and education. Her honors include a Pulitzer Prize, a Clarion Award, and a National Education Writers Association Award. She is the mother of 2 sons. Her book, The Trouble with Boys, a surprising report card on our sons, their problems at school, and what parents and educators must do, is published by Crown. And you'll find our guest online at www.pegtyre.com. And the last name is spelled T-Y-R-E, pegtyre.com. Again, the phone numbers 333-9455 and 800-222-9455. Peg Tyre, good afternoon. Good to talk with you.
Oh, nice to be here. Thanks for having me on.
Sure. This book grew out of a story you did for Newsweek back in 2006, and that story drew a tremendous response. What led you to this story, and would you tell us about the response, positive and negative?
Well, I'll tell you. I was in schools for a couple of years before I even thought about boys. As a former girl myself, I was really more focused on the struggles that girls go through. I had grown up on books like Reviving Ophelia and How School Shortchanged Girls. So I was really more looking for that crisis of self-esteem that girls struggle through, especially in middle school, that tends to depress their academic achievement. So I was in schools about 2 years, and I started to notice just anecdotally, like, wow, the kids who are really struggling here really seem to be boys. And I knew that when I was in poor African-American schools that their struggles were very well documented. Poor African-American boys do very poorly indeed in school compared to middle-class kids. So I was aware that they had a unique set of needs that weren't being met by schools. But then as I traveled through different schools, I started to get a sense that it was a more pervasive problem. It wasn't until I was talking to a headmaster at an elite Manhattan school who mentioned to me that his lowest quartile kids, they had done a big research project. There's nothing in common. All the kids at the bottom of the class, they weren't the arty kids or the goths or the jocks, but they were all boys. And that really fascinated me because I thought, wow, what am I seeing? Am I seeing something that's more broadly across culture than we thought? So I looked at the data, and it turns out, yes, it turns out there's many, many ways in which boys are falling behind. And so I hauled off, and I wrote this cover story for Newsweek, not realizing quite that I was entering into such a cultural hotspot about gender and education. And I wrote the story in a very straightforward way about what I saw and schools that were trying to address this problem.
So, and the response that you got,
the response was intense. I've been a reporter for 20 years, and I've covered public corruption stories, and I've done, environmental pollution stories, and I've done, criminal justice tragedies, and nothing that I've done has gotten anywhere near the response that the story did. Hundreds and hundreds of parents wrote me, and they said, thank you for writing about the central drama of our family life, and that is, my daughter's going to Duke, and my son is barely in community college. And all the moms said, what did I do wrong? And teachers wrote me and they said, you know, we get it. We get that there's kids in the back of the classroom we're not reaching, and we know they're boys, and we want to know more about this. And also some academic feminists wrote me, and they were furious, and they said there is still such an intractable problem with gender equity in the workplace, and gains are so slow in that field. By writing about boys in education, you draw oxygen away from that very important debate. And they were quite aggressive about me being part of some kind of backlash, which is not true. I am a card-carrying member of the feminist movement. I'm a grateful beneficiary of all that my godmothers did to break barriers for me in education and in the professional world. But I do believe in saying what's true. Mm. And right now we have a pervasive underachievement of boys. Not every boy. But, of course, if you look broadly across the nation, it's cause for great concern, I think.
Yeah, long term, what are the consequences of this situation?
Well, let's think. Now, if we have a society that begins to bifurcate, as it certainly has in the working class African-American communities, where, for instance, women are so much better educated than men. What happens? Well, we have the cultural artifact of a book like Waiting to Exhale, where women are all talking about, you know, guys of equal educational attainment. Where are they, right? But that's one of the things that happens. Women don't marry down anymore because we don't have to, because we have earning power of our own. And women are less and less likely to marry someone who has less educational attainment. So guys who don't go to college don't get married as much. They don't stay married once they're married, okay? Education provides a protective effect for your union. So what's the effect? It seems that if this is allowed to continue as it has been, we will see changes that will affect our children, our children's children, how they marry, how they mate, who has children, who raises children, if they can afford to retire. I think the implications will be far-reaching.
Yeah. One of the interesting things to me, and it was a surprise, is, and I mentioned in my introduction that there are now 2.5 million more female undergrads than male grads in colleges. However, this gender imbalance is affecting college admission for women.
Well, that's the part of the academic feminist argument that really cuts against me, because what the academic feminists accuse me of is to say, well, we're drawing attention away from the struggles of in the workplace. But if you look at the college admissions for private universities and private colleges, now publics can't do this because publics have to accept a general ratio of who applies, right? Mm-hmm. But private universities and private colleges, they gender weight. So for example, in many, many highly regarded schools, two-thirds of their applications are from women, one-third are from men, but lo and behold, their class is 50-50, male and female. So what's going on there? What's going on there is we're privileging the most affluent white boys over very high-achieving girls in order to achieve a gender balance. So because we don't address this early on, because we don't address this in preschool and in first grade and second grade and fifth grade and sixth grade, places where boys drop out, we have at the end of the day, when kids are 17 and applying to colleges, we really create a system that disadvantages girls.
Hmm. This is the Afternoon Magazine. Our guest this afternoon is journalist Peg Tyre. She is the author of The Trouble with Boys, a surprising report card on our sons, their problems at school, and what parents and educators must do. My name is Celeste Quinn. Listeners, you can join us this afternoon with questions, comments. The number in the Champaign-Urbana area, 333-9455. That's 333-WILL. And toll-free, 800-222-9455, 800-222-WILL. Let's take a call now from a listener in Champaign on line one. Good afternoon.
Hi, is that me?
Yeah, that's you. Hi.
Oh, great. Wow, I got to be the first one. A couple of things that I wanted to address is in your data, I have two sons with learning disabilities. Did you factor in special education needs that perhaps weren't being addressed? And then second of all, when you're talking about, you know, women and education and not having to marry down and so forth, that really disturbs me, because I think someone's education is not the totality of their person. And you can be well educated and be a real jerk.
So, I mean, I take your point on that one.
I mean, why are we quantifying who is a good person to marry by educational level?
Got that. I speak sort of because I do a lot of big demographic reporting. I do tend to, and it's really more of a turn of phrase, and I'm sorry if it annoyed you, but really what I meant to, let me be a little more specific. What I mean to say and what the data shows is that if you go to college, you have higher earning power. Okay, so we don't marry people who we don't move through class lines anymore in the way that we used to, say, in the 1940s. There was much more marrying up and marrying down. And now there tends to be marrying across lines, not of income, but of educational attainment. So college grads are more likely to marry college grads, and people with doctorate degrees are more likely to marry people with doctorate degrees. Not to say they're good people, or, you know, who's to say what happens to them, but that's actually, if you look at the macro
broad data,
that's what the, you know, broadly, that's been the change. I wasn't trying to imply that someone who didn't have a college
education. I know you weren't. I'm just saying that to me, that's not, it's kind of like the physical look factor.
Got you. Yeah. I'm just saying that, like, when you look
broad. Person is.
Yeah, got you. Totally roger that. But when you look broadly, like, that's like one of the big societal shifts that we're just now sort of coming into, that's really just now coming into view.
Data.
But it will have a huge implication as fewer men become college educated. It'll have a big implication for women. You know, maybe it'll change. Maybe as there is a growing bifurcation across class lines, not just in the poor African American community, but it's certainly now in the middle class African American community, and in the sort of working middle class and the sort of lower middle class white, you see it much more, the bifurcation of educational attainment. So maybe it'll change, but that's what we're looking at now.
And the other part.
What was the first part of what you said? Oh, special ed.
So, learning disabilities.
Right. So boys are twice as likely to be identified with learning disabilities
than
girls. And special education in many communities is about 75% male.
Right. So did that factor in, or are you just talking about the normal students who are male, or did you put that into the whole picture?
That's in the whole picture. So there's a lot of concern now that we're over-identifying boys in particular with having learning disabilities and putting them in special ed, less so now. I think that's really changing now in the last couple of maybe 2 years. But for, you know, the last maybe 15 years, we've put a lot of kids in special ed, and a lot of them are boys, because they don't learn the way we teach. And that's a very broad definition of a learning disability, that the way that we teach has become very, very narrow, and our expectations have become, I think, and I argue in my book, much more rigid. And when kids fail to meet those expectations or fail to toe that rigid line, and many of them are boys, you know, it creates problems for them.
And, I agree.
Yeah.
So, okay, well, that was my question. Thank you.
Cool. Thanks.
Thanks for the call this afternoon. So how many boys are having a tough time in school?
Well, everywhere you look, there's a thin margin of high-performing boys. So I would say at the outset, not every boy. Okay, but when you look apples to apples, so poor black boys to poor black girls, when you look at middle-class white boys to middle-class white girls, affluent to affluent, what you see is that boys' achievement is, for some reason, depressed across all those demographic categories. So it seems, and it is especially keen in areas of reading and writing, which turn out to be, because of our changing curriculum, really the master virtues for school success. Reading, writing, and organization seem to really be critical for school success. So in that way, we spend a lot of time thinking about girls and science, and girls in particularly in computer science and engineering, and I support that. I think that's a good thing. I'd like to see more female physicists. But we don't spend a whole lot of time talking about the male literacy gap, which is huge, getting bigger, and has massive implications for the ability of children, boys, to gain school success.
Mm-hmm. I mentioned in the introduction boys being expelled from preschool. How early are boys running into trouble, and what gets a preschooler expelled?
Well, you know, it really has to do with the changing nature of preschool. I mean, preschool is kind of new in our culture, and it really, there was no sort of golden age of preschool, because really we've just started sending kids to preschool, and you know, in great numbers now. But what's happened is there's been a sort of push down of education and a push down of academics into preschool. So, in, for instance, kindergarten, the curriculum used to be getting your raincoat on a rainy day. And now it's actually real literacy skills. And a lot of that academic pushdown has creeped into preschool. And so there are many, many programs which respond to the natural and inflamed anxieties of parents about getting their kids ready for school and getting them having, you know, the characteristics that will grant them school success later on. And so parents are keen to get early academics, and I think those programs turn out to be very poor for many boys, partially because they don't allow enough physical movement in the school day. And boys, when you look at the science of this, there's people actually study how much movement kids need, and it turns out little boys, some little boys, need a tremendous amount of movement, a lot more than regular, the mainstream. The kids who are outliers, who are ants in the pants, are always boys. And they're the ones who really slam up against the requirements of preschool and kindergarten.
Let's take another call. Let's go next to a listener in Urbana on line one. Good afternoon.
Hi there. I may have missed just the first little bit of the program, but I was curious as to whether or not or what the timeline is on your data, as if this is new information or if this is new in 50 years or new 50 years ago or whatever. And I will listen offline.
Okay. How recent?
Okay, so here's how it looked. It used to be that back in the 40 years ago, that many, many more boys than girls went to college. Those numbers changed around the late 80s. So there was a point at which we had parity, and since then, many the gap between the numbers of girls going to college and the number of boys going to college has widened to the extent that by 2016, the U.S. Department of Education thinks it'll be 40-60 males to females on college campuses. So it's really a massive reversal from what we've seen in the past. Now, in terms of scores, in terms of how kids actually do in school, in the last 15 years, we've seen high school students, their dynamic and engagement in high school really change. For instance, what am I talking about? For instance, extracurricular activities, intramural sports, class play, the yearbook, the newspaper, student council. Boys do more sports now, but have withdrawn from every other form of extracurricular activity. And that's new in the last 8 years. In terms of girls catching up to boys in math and science, that's new, and that's over about 10 years, in the last 10 years. Boys falling behind in reading and writing, also, we're talking about a 10-year. Well, actually, I lie. Boys have always been behind in reading, but in the last 15 years have even fallen further behind in writing. So some of the timelines are a little different, like the way that the data is collected is not all from a single central time point in the timeline, but I think sort of looking at the demographic trends over the last 10 years or 12 years, it's very pronounced.
Let's take another call. A listener in Mattoon, line two. Hi.
Hi, I love your program. I just wanted to concur with the aspect of little boys needing places to run and burn off that energy, kind of like a beagle, if you will. My son's now a junior in high school, but his teachers he's that child that would butt up against that those barriers, and a lot of the consequences for him were, well, when the other kids go out to play, you'll sit in your seat.
Oh,
of course, exacerbates the problem. So
right. Yeah, that's a barbaric practice. I mean, and I think that teachers don't mean it to be, they're trying to get some of the best out of our kids, but that is exactly the way not to do it. Because if a child needs to move, I think you need to get them to move in order to get them to be at attention. Or, I mean, people who study this say that, but we do reflexively the opposite.
Does the listener have a follow-up? No.
I chased him away. I'm sorry.
No, I don't think so. I don't know. We've got a problem maybe in the control room this afternoon. I don't know. Well, let's go and take another call. That was a great call. Thanks to that listener. Next, we go to a listener in Urbana. Line 3, hi.
Hi. Is this line 3?
Yeah, you're on.
Okay. And I won't get discouraged, I promise. I was so intrigued by the first lady who called. But I think that the issues are far more than just school-oriented, and by the way, I've taught for almost 40 years, and there is absolutely no doubt that academics are pushed lower and lower and lower, and girls are much readier, much earlier to be successful. I'm discouraged by the thought that maybe our boys are going to feel like failures before they are even 8 years old, and I see that occurring through no obvious direction on the part of those that run the schools, but almost all preschools are actually run by women. But I think it goes way beyond that. I think our society is very conflicted about what we actually see as manly. You see fashion models that have this sort of metrosexual stance, but that's not what most Americans actually see as masculine. And yet you'll see this kind of ambivalence. Way back in the 60s, we began to see different roles in our society. And our boys right now, they don't have some roles. We used to have, teams in neighborhoods that played games, and everybody played kickball, and you got picked, and you were going to get picked earlier as you got a little bit older. But all of the academics and all of the athletics today are divided up by your age group. And, of course, only a few people really succeed. I'm not a bit surprised to see fewer and fewer boys participating in many activities across the whole spectrum. I would love to have your guest address this. It's a great program, and you're doing a wonderful job. Don't abandon this thought. It's important.
Okay.
Bye-bye.
Bye. Thanks for the call.
I swear that it's not my sister. I did not set up a plan. Well, I concur, of course, that the push down in academics has been very bad for a lot of kids. It's been very good for a lot of kids, and we do it for very moral reasons, but I think we've pushed up against the boundaries of human development in a lot of cases. I think that for many boys, they're just not there yet. In terms of changing societal values and roles, I think that's surely true. I think that we are very clear about what we want from our girls in school. I think we're very clear. We model very clearly what we want for them. I think it's when they get out into the workforce and they're of childbearing age that then we get very complicated about what we want our girls to be. Then we really ambush them with completely contradictory messages. But I think those contradictory messages come very early for boys. And I think there are very few clear pathways to manhood for boys. I don't write a lot about the whole manhood, passage to manhood stuff, just because I'm female and I don't really know about it. And I think there's people who do a better job than that. But looking at it broadly, it is a huge change in the culture.
I thought it was very interesting that this caller, this teacher, said it used to be that kids were with kids and out on the playground or in after school or summer activities, you had a range of ages and abilities of kids being with one another. And I can remember that from my childhood, kids taking care of kids. And
so interesting is how the play has changed for children. I mean, there's just been papers, white papers issued by the American Pediatric Association, defending play. I mean, what's going on? Kids really don't play anymore in the way that we played 40 years ago. And it's very troubling. I mean, it used to be 30 years ago, you'd see kids in a little undeveloped place between two housing developments with a net, and you'd think, oh, they're catching frogs. You know, and now you think, where are their parents? Do they know they're out? You know, there's a whole anxiety about children being on their own and not having adult-directed play.
Okay.
It's very new, and I think very destructive to a lot of kids. A lot of them are boys.
Let's go back to our caller from Mattoon. He's called in with a follow-up. Our dad in Mattoon, line two, hi.
Hi, and I wanted to ask the question. I apologize, we got cut off last time. I wonder, particularly looking at primary education, if there, when your statistics showed the separation between the genders, if in fact you did any sort of gathering of statistics regarding the gender of the teacher.
Good question.
Take that answer offline. Thank you.
Okay, thanks for the call.
Okay, so that's a really good question. And here's how, like, first of all, I want to say at the outset that having written a lot about education and spent a lot of time in schools, I'm a little protective of female teachers. And here's why, because females have children and they raise children, and by and large, they do the lion's share of educating children. So I don't want to put this problem solely at their feet and say just because they're females, they're somehow failing, okay? That said, we are at a time when male teachers are at a 40-year low. So there's many, many fewer male teachers now than there were in times past. And does it matter? It seems that, yes, indeed it does, that in some big longitudinal studies have shown that male teachers depress the achievement of female students and female teachers depress the achievement of male students in some subjects. But when there's no male teachers, the result of that is that boys do worse. Now, a cautionary note, I called the people who did this study. I was very excited because, you know, in researching my book, I thought, wow, this is the silver bullet. And this is the answer, right? Because I was, of course, looking for the easy answer. And the people who did the study sort of cautioned me and said, look, gender is not the whole answer. We don't actually know what happens in the classroom. We know broadly there are this result, but it seems to us that good teaching is good teaching no matter what the envelope of the teacher looks like. And certainly that statement is borne out in research. Good teachers find ways to teach all kinds of kids. But something happens in terms of gender, and yet we, as a culture, we don't spend a lot of time thinking or talking about that.
Yeah. Here, before we go on to the next caller, maybe you would tell us about a third, fourth grade teacher by the name of Kay Kobe.
Oh, she's so wonderful. So here's a teacher, a veteran, and I have to tell you, this book really has connected with veteran teachers and also with grandparents because they remember a different way and they remember a different time. And they remember a time when blocks in kindergarten and first grade were standard. Now, Kay Kobe is a teacher in Westchester, and she has held on to her blocks straight through third grade. And she understands that when you play with blocks, you're really learning about math. And, yes, she does all the state testing, but she also allows kids to have a more hands-on approach to academic subjects. And she's really had to fight hard to keep that going in her class. And she says she feels sorry for the younger teachers who don't feel as empowered to really keep those things in the class.
Hmm. Okay, now let's go to another caller. Champagne, line four. Good afternoon.
Yeah, hi, Celeste. Another great show. Thanks for taking my call. Just a couple of two quick comments for your guests, and I'll ring off. Actually, last night I was watching the nightly news with Charlie Gibson. And I think what dovetails nicely into your program, they started something called Dad Watch. I think it's dadwatch.com, actually getting fathers back involved in the classroom. And this was just a groundswell of some dads that were concerned about the progress their kids were making, I think primarily boys, and where the father actually comes into the classroom and assists the teacher. And anyway, it says it's having an enormous positive effect. So I don't know if you're familiar with that program or not, but I thought that would be of interest. Where I'm coming from is I'm in my 50s, so I went to grammar school about a million years ago. And I've got a 13-year-old daughter and an 8, and they're both doing very well in public school. But what's opening my eyes up here, and I was wondering if your study had any comparisons, is to the effect of the breakdown of the American family and single parents and all of that. And the level of violence and sex is enormous, and the pressures must be just huge. We went to a football game just a small eastern Illinois town, and the two kids, I can't imagine this in my 50s, but the two kids in school actually beat up the principal and sent them to the hospital, and the hospital and the school board is figuring about keeping the principal because they thought he overstepped his bounds. And I have a sister-in-law who's a teacher in fourth grade. She sent a note home with Johnny. You know, Johnny's misbehaving. Parents, 9 times out of 10, call her up at home and call her every name under the sun. Instead of supporting the teachers, there's this atmosphere out there that I think is just toxic. And I have to blame the parents, or maybe it's the environment. And I just was wondering about your comments on that. Thanks.
Okay.
Well, that's a lot of information, but let me just cherry pick the stuff that I know about. First of all, I think that definitely single parent households have an effect. I'm not entirely clear what that effect is. When you look at the data for single parent households, and we're often talking about, we're almost always talking about single mom households. So when you look at the data out there, it seems that kids who are raised in single parent households have poorer outcomes. They don't get as much education. They have more contact with the criminal justice system. They're more likely to be on welfare, to experience joblessness. But that data is not really like disaggregated for poverty. And single parenting is definitely correlated with high rates of poverty. So it's unclear to me when you look at those numbers whether you're really looking at the effect of poverty or you're really looking at the effect of single parenting. Okay, so but put that aside for a second. And we know that 33% of boys don't live with their biological fathers. Okay, so that stands to reason, right? When I read that number, I think, okay, I get that. Divorce, blended families, single mom households, right? And I think, well, you know, when I first started looking at that number, I didn't really blink because I understand where that comes from. But then when I thought about it a little bit, I thought, what if 33% of girls were not living with their biological mothers? I mean, imagine just turning that number on its head, okay? There would be a whole section in Barnes & Noble dedicated to the psychological journey that girls go on separated from their biological mothers, right? There'd be whole schools in graduate schools focusing on those issues, those psychological issues. There'd be a subsection of academics who made that their life's work, okay? But we don't really talk about what the effect is for boys because I think I've come to the conclusion after looking at this pretty hard, we don't talk about it because we don't want to talk about it. We want boys to be okay with it because it's better for us as adults. We don't really focus on what it really means to a boy, and we sort of ignore it. We reinforce by our silence, we reinforce a kind of stoicism. We enforce a kind of stoicism on our boys. We want them really emotionally to be the Marlboro Man. I mean, women say, oh, yeah, we'd like boys to be more emotional, and we'd like men to be more emotional, except we don't really want to deal with, like, the underlying psychological issues that we might be, as adults, laying down for them as children. I'm not, like, a, you know, radical dad's rights person or anything, but I have to think that it has an impact on boys. It has a really big impact on boys.
Let's take another call. A listener in Champaign on line one. Good afternoon.
Hello.
Hi.
You're going to think that this is a kind of a joke, but it's not. I'm really serious in asking it. But I'm wondering, I'm sitting here trying to think of what separates boys from girls, you know, and the only thing I can come up with is testosterone level. And I'm wondering whether the level of testosterone somehow interferes with the absorption of information or the...
Women would tell you yes.
Or even the desire to learn, you know. But I've got a PhD in psychology, and I'm very curious about these kinds of variables.
Do you have any information
on that at all?
That's a good question. You know, I spent a lot of time looking at brain difference in boys and girls, and I'll tell you why, because there's a lot of popular literature about the difference in the boy and girl brain, and, you know, Mars and Venus and all that. And at first, I have to say, when I first looked at that material, I was pretty enthusiastic about it because it explained in a popular way, in a casual way, what, of course, I had seen my whole life, which is that men and women are different. And raising children, you really, you know, I was one of those moms, those irritating PC moms who, like, put their kids in, like, yellow buntings and stuff because I didn't want to put any gender stereotyping on them. That was me, okay? But then when you go, you know, log as many hours as I have at the playground, you see that, by and large, boys and girls are pretty different. So reading those popular books, I did say, like, well, it confirmed a lot of what I saw casually. But when I drilled down into it and talked to neuroscientists and talked to people who really study and have made their life's work the study of gender and and brain science, what they tell you is that it's really much more complicated than that. Like, there is no boy, there's no way that boys learn and way that girls learn. There's no boy and girl brain. And yes, there are differences, and yes, there's testosterone in one and oxytocin in another, but when we don't really know what those things mean and what they do. And when we get ahead of the science, we get in a very slippery slope. You know, it wasn't too long ago that we said that women didn't have the right brain size to vote and blacks didn't have the right brain size to own property. So we've used the misunderstanding of science as a way to enforce our own social prejudices since the dawn of history, since the dawn of brain science. So I'm really cautious. I write a chapter in my book about brain science, and I hope you get a chance to take a look at it because I think it's a little more complicated than we want it to be.
Mm. I'm sorry, go ahead.
Again, it's another easy answer that I thought I had but sort of slipped through my fingers. It's a complex problem, but one I think that's really worth talking about.
Mm. Peg Tyer is our guest this afternoon here on the Afternoon Magazine. She is the author of The Trouble with Boys, a surprising report card on our sons, their problems at school, and what parents and educators must do. Let's take another call now, a listener on line 3 in Urbana. Line 2 in Champaign. Good afternoon. Hi.
Hi. I've been an educator, though not a teacher per se. I've been a school social worker, a substitute teacher, and I ran an academic after-school program. And I'm really concerned about No Child Left Behind, which some of my colleagues have called No School Left Standing, because it doesn't really measure adequate yearly progress. It doesn't measure progress at all. It measures one point in time with one group, and then a year later, another point of time with another group. And if children come in with what are now considered deficits, since you were mentioning the push down into kindergarten and preschool of the academics, they might start where children used to start in kindergarten, and that makes them maybe 2 years behind. And then they get to third grade when the testing starts. They might start third grade at pre-primer level reading, and they might come up to the beginning of second grade, which would be two or more years progress. But then they test at, you know, they're a year or a year and a half behind. So the test says, oh, they didn't make progress.
Right.
So I think this affects boys a lot because boys are less ready, at the age when they start than girls are. So I wonder what you have to say about NCLB.
Well, I have to say that I spent a lot of time in schools, and I may be the one person on the planet who's not an NCLB hater, and here's why. When you look at the national data, the way we educate poor kids, poor black kids and Latino kids compared to the way we educate middle-class white kids, it's a national disgrace. I mean, the difference in achievement, it's terrible. And when you really look at those numbers, sometimes I can't believe there's not people on the street protesting about it. It's really bad, and it's really un-American. So to the extent that the framers of No Child Left Behind wanted to focus the nation on that gap, I applaud that. I think that's a really good thing. To the extent that they put a law in place that's deeply flawed and is creating havoc in our schools, especially in our middle-class schools, I think it's really problematic. So I don't hate No Child Left Behind. I see why they did it, and I think it's for good reasons, but I do see that it's had some problems and created some big problems for the way we teach children. For instance, what troubles me is that the curriculum has gotten so much more narrow. And in many schools that you go into, what gets tested gets taught. So really there are test prep factories for English and math. And what's fallen away? Well, recess has fallen away, which is a big problem. So is art, so is music, so is history. So is hands-on science. So school has become much more driven by state standards. Now, there should be state standards enforced. State standards, I think, are a good thing. But the way they're being interpreted at a school level is, I think, very problematic. And I think it's very bad for a lot of children. But I think of boys in this case as sort of like the canaries in the mine. And they're sort of reacting. You can make girls, some girls do it, but boys are not as compliant. And I see them really acting up and falling out as a result of this narrowing of the curriculum and a more pressurized curriculum.
I want to thank the listener for her call, and we're drawn down on time, and I've got some other callers who would like to talk with Peg Tyer. So let's go next to a listener on line 3 in Urbana. Good afternoon.
Hi there.
Hi.
Hi, I'm reading a book called Why Gender Matters, and I'm sure you've read it or heard parts of it. And it's I'm also very much a feminist and lesbian, and said I will not fall in support of gender stereotyping. And we have a 2.5-year-old boy, and he. I'm shocked. It's amazing.
It's great.
Yeah, it's an amazing experience. He is very, very physical and active and has to be moving. And he's also all the other amazing things, too, because he's my child, right? But he is very active. He needs to move his body and also can be very aggressive. And it's been difficult to figure out how to work with him. And so I've been trying to read a good bit and talk to people. This book talks a little bit about the brain. Also, as you talked about this, being careful not to, you know, try to figure those as answers. But I found it intriguing that he's claiming that boys and girls, their eyes see colors differently.
Yeah, I don't really go for that. I have to say, what happens with barn sparrows or something? The examples that he uses and the studies that he uses, I don't think we can really apply them to humans. And I will say, here's the thing that worries me about all this brain science. And we know that the brain is very plastic, and the attitudes of authorities, doctors, teachers, parents can actually change the way children's brains function. And what am I talking about? I'm talking about a very robust body of research called the stereotype threat. So we know that if we test girls, two groups of girls in math, and we give them the same math test, but we say to one group of girls, girls don't have the gene to be good at math, okay? Those girls will do worse on their math tests. Not because they have less aptitude, but because if you're in a position of authority, you can change the way a child's brain functions. So when we read these books about brain science and how, you know, girls see light or do better in pink rooms or yellow rooms, and boys do better when the temperature is 90 degrees or 70, you know, I'm familiar with this book. There's all kinds of like physical, they're like minute physical differences. I think that we're on thin ice, because if that's true, then let's prove it. Let's our children deserve like to have studies done to see if those things really are true. Otherwise, I worry that. What's happened is I've been in classrooms where teachers have gotten very hyped on this brain difference stuff, and they start to say things like, well, girls just like to sit on the rug and interact, and boys like to run around. Girls like to do that because they have oxytocin, and boys like to do that because they have testosterone. Well, you know, that's the grossest kind of gender stereotyping. It makes me uncomfortable. It feels like the 1950s to me, and I don't want to go back there. I think that we need to be pretty careful about how we integrate what we think we know about brain science. I think it's better to go with what we know. One thing we know is the stereotype threat. It's huge, and it's very, very real. We have to be careful of that. Another thing we know is maturation. From that, one of the things we know, like cold in terms of neuroscience, is that maturation rates are different for boys and girls. And that's huge. That right there is huge. Like that a boy doesn't really have all that he needs for his brain to function efficiently until he's 24, 25 years old. Girls have it when they're 16. Like that right there is a massive, should have a massive effect, measurable, demonstrable effect. But, you know, and to go beyond that, I think I just find it questionable and worrisome.
Hmm. I'm going to have to wrap things up now. I want to ask you one more question. We've got other callers. I'm just sorry we're out of time. But before we go, Peg Tyer, I want you to talk just a little bit about Wilmette, Illinois, and Max McGee. This is a place that we all know here in Illinois. Per pupil expenditure is way up there. And now he noticed a real problem. Girls with hands raised, he's the superintendent there, or was, girls with hands raised, boys in the back, checked out. He said, something's wrong here. How did he and the district's teachers go about trying to get the boys engaged? And we've only got like maybe a minute or two at the most here.
Yeah, make it super fast.
Yeah, super fast.
And I hope people get a chance to check it out. But what he did is he basically launched a gender study. And he looked at the grades and he looked at who's getting the behavioral referrals and who's getting the special ed referrals. And he brought the information to the community and the teachers. And they wanted to act on it. And they wanted to be sure not to hurt their high-performing girls, but they had very little tolerance for boys will be boys. They didn't really buy that. And the teachers, the great teachers of that school district, really took wonderful steps to re-engage boys. They were not things that cost a lot of money. They were things that took intention and a deliberate plan. But I have to say I was very impressed by what happened in that school district. They didn't have to take that on. But as you find in many affluent school districts, they're beginning to look at this problem as, they really feel they need to get all children engaged.
Hmm. And if Wilmette can do it without a lot of money, there's hope for the rest of us, huh?
Well, I think I'm very hopeful about this, and here's why. Because teachers changed it for me. Teachers told me, asked me, what do you want to be? I said, a stewardess. They said, no, be a pilot. What do you want to be? A secretary. No, be a lawyer. Teachers changed it for me. They whispered in my ear. They created aspirations for me. They showed me the escalator that carries children from sophomore year in high school to senior year in college. They showed that to me. And I think that teachers, given the support from the community, given the support from their administrators, can do the same for boys.
There we have to wrap it up. Peg, thank you very much for talking with us this afternoon.
Oh, my pleasure.
Peg Tyer is the author of The Trouble with Boys, a surprising report card on our sons, their problems at school, and what parents and educators must do. The publisher is Crown. You'll find our guest online at www.pegtyer.com. And Tyer is spelled T-Y-R-E.